This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
We've got Bryce Tolliday, who's a Senior Access Consultant from Wayfinding Australia. And Bryce is going to be presenting to us today about a disability discrimination advocacy case study with a positive outcome. Thanks, Bryce.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, as a friend of mine who Nadia knows, Ivan was telling the story once about a conference he went to, and the majority of the people in the audience were hearing impaired, and the presenter at the time asked them to put their hand up if they couldn't hear him. Anyway, okay, my name's Bryce Tolliday. As introduced, I'm an access consultant with a firm called Wayfinding Australia, or Access Always Consultants. I've been an access consultant now for too long, probably about 30-odd years. Nadia knows me very well. I got involved with this Peter Ryan many years ago now, and the complaint that he lodged against the Sunshine Coast Hospital and Health Service, which I'll go through now. The complaint went on for nearly 6 years, so I'm going to try and compress this into 30 minutes. See how we go. Okay, so the school, as it's commonly known up on the Sunshine Coast, which is Sunshine Coast University Hospital, is a 660-bed tertiary hospital that was completed in 2016 for a small cost of just over $2 billion. The hospital won numerous design awards and engineering awards, which usually for us access consultants tell us that there's going to be some problems. Okay, Peter Ryan, as I said, was I've known Peter for a long, long time. Lovely bloke. He's legally blind. I don't know if any of you in the room ever met Peter Ryan, but yeah, he's a legally blind man with who had diabetic retinopathy. He's probably presented with visual fluctuations, hazy vision. He was very sensitive to glare and light, and he had a lot of issues reading fine detail. As he got older, particularly when he could no longer have a guide dog, he started to get mobility issues. He became very obese, in fact, bariatric. He also then started presenting emphysema, renal issues, and as you'll hear during this, he eventually passed away before the court decision was handed down. So the hospital, as all big projects do, went through a series of public consultations between 2010 and 2012, of which Peter attended almost all of them. Construction and provided them with quite a few suggestions about what he'd like to see in the lovely new hospital we were going to get on the Sunshine Coast. Construction commenced in 2012. This is an unusual hospital because it was built under what's called a private-public partnership. It wasn't built by the state government. So the PPP consisted of some well-known players such as Lendlease, Architectus, a firm called Spotless, and Spotless still maintain the hospital. They have a maintenance contract with the hospital for 20 years. The hospital opened in March 2017. As I said, it won numerous awards. From the very first day that Peter went there, he had problems, lots of problems. And he engaged with the hospital during 2018 to see what could be done to sort out his issues with actually using the hospital. In the end, he lodged a DDA complaint, which I encouraged him to do in 2019. We had one conciliation conference in the Human Rights Commission, which lasted about 10 minutes, and we walked out. And then we referred the matter straight to the Federal Circuit Court in May. Peter engaged myself and another access consultant, Penny Galbraith, some of you may know Penny, to assist as his experts in the trial. And the hospital, or the health service, engaged Architecture and Access, a lady by the name of Trish Flores, to assist them. Court submissions and hearings were held during 2019 and the first half of 2020. Again, we didn't really get very far, and we finished up in a hearing in July 2020. Peter passed away in April 2021, and the federal court handed down its orders in July 2021, 3 months after he passed away. So I'll try and explain to you some of the issues that Peter was confronted with quickly. The hospital had a forecourt out the front of it that was about 10,000 square metres in size, which is rather large. On one side of the forecourt was a bus station, which Peter would occasionally use when he was more mobile. On the other side of the forecourt was the was a U-shaped road area, which was a set-down area for pedestrians, or for people. It contained some short-term car parking, and it also contained an emergency drop-off area for emergency vehicles, not ambulances. We're talking about police and fire. The entire pathway in that area was at grade with the road, and there were no TGSIs. The building certifier decided that bollards were sufficient barrier for pedestrians. And interestingly, when I lodged a professional complaint against the building certifier, the Queensland Building Commission agreed with the certifier that bollards were fine. There was the front of the hospital was full of full-height glazing, frameless. There was no vision strips anywhere. And there was no connection via way of TGSIs from the bus station to the hospital. There was pieces of furniture and poles in the middle of all the pedestrian areas. None of those had any luminance contrast with the ground surface. And there were wayfinding signs in that area, and there was no tactile or braille information on the signs. In fact, the orientation of the sign was the opposite to the way it was supposed to be. Within the hospital, it just got worse. The signage in the hospital had text. There was, on the main information signs, there was over 70 destinations, and the text was 6 millimetres high. A person with normal vision couldn't read them. I actually took a photo of an old chap there, and he was standing with his eyes about 100 millimetres away from the sign, and he had normal vision trying to read what was on it. There was a map on the sign that was at knee height, and the text on the map was 3 millimetres high. In the hospital itself, the floor surfaces were polished. There was glass everywhere. The wall surfaces were polished. The lift lobbies were a nightmare if you had a vision impairment, because it was just, you just walked into this light space that was just horrible. And again, there was no signage in the lift lobby that a person with vision impairment could read. All the corridors, the walls were white, the floors were white, and the roofs were white. And there were white columns along the edges of the walls in most of the corridors. There was glass balustrading on level one that looked over a void. And again, there was just no way you could detect it. Polished stainless steel handrails, highly reflective surfaces. Furniture was stacked along the shorelines everywhere, and there was no luminance contrast between any of the pieces of furniture and the floor. It did win design awards. So the matter of the complaint was about the, as I said, the warning, no warning TGSIs in any of the emergency external pedestrian areas where the path was at grade with the road. There were no vision strips at any of the entrance doors or along any of the glazing. All the corridors, etc., all the same colour. There was glare everywhere, glass balustrading. There was no connection from the public transport bus station to the hospital entrance. There was no raised tactile and braille signs anywhere apart from on toilets, which is required by the National Construction Code. The defence from the hospital was laughable, but the defence relied on... they had a letter from their building certifier and from their access consultant that said that the building complied fully with the building code and complied fully with the Disability Discrimination Act. And the access consultant and the building certifier were the same firm.
Where did they get their access consulting degree out of a bully paddle?
The hospital relied in their defence on the fact that they provided volunteers to assist as necessary. The volunteer station was almost always empty. The volunteers go home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And Peter, what triggered Peter's complaint, he rang me. I was actually travelling around Australia, and he rang me, and I was in Western Australia. He was in tears. His appointment ran over time, and he came out of his appointment about 5:15. There were no volunteers. This is a massive hospital. No one to help him. He couldn't read any signs. He had to go to the toilet, and he finished up wetting his pants in the middle of the hospital. The hospital engaged a set an access consultant to examine the hospital and against the complaint that had been made. The access consultant that the hospital engaged said that a lot of the items that were being asked for were not mandatory. We couldn't agree with that, because what she was saying was that because it wasn't required by the building code, it's not required to be done, which is utter rubbish. So the matter was set down for hearing. At the hearing, because the other side realised that we were going to put to the court that wasn't at the federal court that decided what was mandatory and what wasn't mandatory, the other side then removed the words non-mandatory from their defence, which virtually meant they 100% agreed with everything that we were asking for. Also, as part of the cross-examination, which was funny, we had the director of the Capital Works for Queensland Health on the stand, and we tabled the Queensland Health Capital Works design guideline and asked him if he knew what that was. He said he did. At that stage, his face went white. Then we referred to pages which said, does this page say that all the signage must be raised tactile and braille? He said yes. And does this paragraph say that there must be no glare in the hospital? He said yes. Does this page say that shorelines must be easy to detect? He said yes. And then we asked, well, why didn't you do it? So the orders were set down by the court after Peter passed away, that the forecourt, TGSIs had to be in the emergency set down area and at all areas which were at grade, that all the TGSIs had to have 45% luminance contrast and be a minimum of 600 wide, and that there was to be a TGSI connection to the public transport. They've actually done that. I wouldn't suggest you use the connection to the public transport, because the edge of the directional tiles are 100 millimetres from a column, which is just wonderful. The bollards were then also all painted black, because there was no luminance contrast between the bollards that they had. All the seats and the columns within the forecourt, and all the columns and all the walls and floors within the hospital were required to have luminance contrast treatment for a minimum height of 200 millimetres at the base, or for a minimum width of 300 millimetres at the base. Vision strips were to be installed along all glass entrances and all glass walls. And vision strips were to be placed along all glass balustrading. There was also a requirement that vertical vision strips be placed around glass doors to act as contrast around the frames, which is good. All the polished floors, this is the entire flooring of the entire hospital, had to be replaced with a matte finish flooring. Interesting about the flooring was it was actually specified as a matte finish, and Spotless polished it. All polished wall surfaces were to be taken back to a matte finish. All disabling glare is to be removed. All external directional signs to have information on in raised tactile and braille. All lift directories, floor directories, directional signs and room signs throughout the entire hospital, which I thought was interesting, not the public areas, we're talking about operating theatres and everywhere, has to be raised tactile and braille between a height of 1200 and 600, including all maps had to be raised tactile and braille. The minimum cap height on any lettering was to be 15 millimetres. all freestanding signs to have 30% luminance contrast with the floor surface. This was all in the court orders. Okay, this is now precedent at law. All the couches were to be moved away from shorelines where they didn't have a 30% luminance contrast with the ground or floor or wall surface. All glass balustrading to have polished metal handrails replaced with timber handrails and have contrasting strips placed at floor level. So where do we get to? How are we going with all of that? So it's... So I've actually been on the television this in the last week about this complaint. Some of my mates are calling me a media tart. So we're 2 years into the orders. We're 3 years since the hospital knew what they had to do. The tactiles have been installed in the forecourt area at the emergency set down with a connection to the public transport station. They're not correct, but they're there. The bollards have been refinished. The shorelining within the hospital has partly been addressed. It's not been addressed everywhere. Vision strips have been applied to the entrance glazing and also to the level one balustrading. And some furniture has been relocated. What's still got to be done? The balustrade handrails have not been replaced, and I understand at the moment they're still considering design options on that. This is 2 years later. The polished flooring, they said they'd come up with a way a year and a half ago to deal with the polished flooring. They've done that, didn't work. I've talked to a number of designers and they say there is no way you can bring a polished floor back to a matte finish. It's got to be replaced. Which if they replace it means the hospital's got to be decanted. All the wayfinding signage has not been touched. They are saying at the moment, we had a letter from their lawyers, I'm sorry, we're supposed to be at positive outcomes.
Yeah.
We had a letter from their lawyers 2 weeks ago which said that they were going out to tender on the wayfinding in August. They wouldn't at that stage provide us with any examples of what they were proposing to do. We went back fairly quickly with a very stern letter and then they provided us with a graphic of the new volunteer centre that they're going to put in there, which the court specifically said they weren't allowed to rely on volunteers. So I haven't got a lot of joy with that. They did a lot of public consultation. My firm designed the wayfinding solution 6 months after the decision was handed down and Queensland Health accepted it. And we managed to reuse almost every sign in the hospital. They're now going with an entire replacement of every sign. And there's a reason for that. And it's to do with the way the public-private partnership is funded. So Spotless get maintenance annually for every sign that's in the hospital. If they replace them with new signs, they get maintenance on the new signs plus on the existing ones that no longer will be there. So it's a double whammy for them.
So it's a positive nightmare on their part.
Yeah, not good. The shorelining treatments have not been completed yet. So I'm doing really well. So what does this all mean? Well, it means that the Ryan decision has established an important and significant precedent at law regards the design and construction of new buildings and how the interior of buildings are designed. So most of you probably don't realise that the building code in this country doesn't deal with building interiors. It only deals with the structure. So the Ryan decision has now taken building design in this country to a level it's not been at before. The Australian Building Codes Board has at this stage not reacted to the Ryan decision. The Department of Industry and Commerce, who are responsible for the premises standard, were interested at one stage. On the Standards Committee, we were quite hopeful because we were getting some very positive noise from one chap at Department of Industry who had a had a really good way of dealing with this wayfinding and interior finishes, and his approach was, well, they can just do performance solutions if it's not being done when the building is built, because often you'll get a building, it's a shell, and then people will come and do a fit-out, and we had to make sure the Ryan decision applied to the fit-out. So if they did a performance solution approach, that meant that whoever fitted out the building had to comply with the performance solution. So it meant that the fit-out would incorporate everything that was in the Ryan decision. As far as AS 1428 Part 4 Part 2 goes, I've already redrafted that standard to reflect the Ryan decision. It's with the main committee, but the committee has no motivation to do it because neither the premises standard or the building code at this stage is being amended. Hopefully, at some stage in the future, we get some movement in that direction, because our standards at the moment are inconsistent with international standards in that regard, where they quite strongly deal with glare, measure glare, and, you know, raised tactile and braille signs are everywhere. People like yourselves, the vision impaired community, can now advocate for that level of access with confidence, because to not pay attention to the Ryan decision would mean that you're breaking the law. So that's all I've got about that. I'm glad to ask any questions, and I'll let who's going to manage that.
Okay, before we get to the questions, we've just got a little token of our appreciation for you. Thank you so much.
Oh,
and just really great, because, you know, otherwise we wouldn't know what's going on. So, yeah, really appreciate this.
Who wants to go first?
There's a side of people doing
questions. Nadia? Senoi, no, you get first go. Mike? Rowena? Okay.
Rowena, I live on the Sunshine Coast. I'm a very constant user of Sunshine Coast University Hospital, so very interested to hear that case. Thank you. So I'd like to just quickly say my experience of using the hospital is that you cannot get around it on your own as a person with no vision. You can't even find large print or tactile braille signs. Unless you know where to look, and I don't read fluent braille anyway and can't read raised letters. My husband and I have both written to the hospital and said we're both blind people. There's never any volunteers when you're there. It doesn't matter what time of day or night you're there, there's no volunteers to help. And their written reply was, well, we do provide volunteers. Well, where are they? Secondly, if you don't have a support worker with you, you rely on orderlies / wardsmen to come and get you. So you turn up at reception at the main entrance, say, I need to get to an outpatient clinic. They say there's nobody available, sit there and wait. 30 to 40 minutes later, a wardsman may turn up with a wheelchair. And I've already missed my appointment by then. Really glad to hear of the changes you've made, but realistically there's still a lot of problems. For example, in outpatient departments, they have a beep, beep, beep that flashes up a number and an arrow about where you need to go, which room you need to go for your appointment. And I pointed out that that's not at all helpful for somebody who is blind or vision impaired. And they said, well, we have volunteers and they would come and get you when your number comes up. Well, I have never seen a volunteer in outpatient departments. So you go to the check-in counter and they give you a piece of paper with a number written on it. And I say, can you please let the medical or nursing staff know that I'm waiting and they need to come and get me when the number comes up? I'm sure I've quite often been overlooked and missed an appointment. Thank you.
Can I just add something to that? So part of what the hospital I know are looking at is a system like Bindi Maps, where you can, on your mobile phone, find your way around the hospital. Yeah. But I don't think that's going to be the whole answer, because there are better systems out there which actually will guide you to the actual room on time for your appointment and notify you of your appointment, and they can be linked into the kiosks that they that they're supposedly going to employ in the hospital to replace the ones that they've got.
Erica speaking. Not really a surprise to Bryce that Nadia and my hand went up straight away. Firstly, I just wanted to say that the Standards Committee on AS 1428 Part 4.2, which is wayfinding, we had so much pushback from the Building Code Board during the process that it was like they'd go, no, that's not on the table, that's not on the table, that's not on the table, that it was just so difficult to get anything useful into the wayfinding standard. And the second thing I wanted to say was I thought it was common knowledge that the Disability Discrimination Act trumped the Building Code.
Well, it does now.
Hi, Bryce.
Hey, Nadia.
Oh, my God, so many, like, stop. Firstly, I want to recognise Peter for all the amazing work that he did to get this, to reach this decision. I was shattered the day that I found out that he passed away and the decision had not been reached yet. So I'm hoping wherever he is that he's kind of a bit joyous, but I'm also understanding he's probably frustrated as hell. So we're a bunch of people here. There are organisations here. There are service providers here. What can we do? And I know the DDA's out there. Frankly, I have thoughts around that, which I'm not going to say. But what can we do as a sector, as opposed to, like, it's very onerous to lodge a complaint. Like, Peter would have gone through hell. And I, you know, and the support that he would have got from you and other people in the sector would have been amazing. But he would have gone through hell and it would have all been on him and he would have made to have been looked like an absolute fool, sometimes I would suspect in those hearings, or ignorant or whatever. How do we as a sector come together and just like, this is ridiculous? What are your thoughts? Can we do it? I know there's legislation, but I don't know.
In 3 minutes or less.
Yeah.
I think Peter was lucky because it was, as Nadia said, it was extremely difficult for him. He was under a lot of pressure, but he was fortunate that he had a senior counsel and a lawyer who were donating their time, which is unusual. And in the end, it was good for them because they got their costs. But, you know, when you go to the federal court, you don't know if you're going to get costs because you don't know if you're going to win. We were confident, but Peter was just fortunate that he had really good legal representation.
Thanks, Bryce. That was a very good presentation, and it highlighted a few things for myself and the questions sort of following. And I think Peter's done a great job in advocating and taking this to a legislative level to try and make some changes to support our infrastructure moving forward. One of the things that highlighted to me, immediately that we're in a private-public partnership relationship to build a new hospital where I am at the moment with Lendlease as the one of the partners. So very interesting to take that away from today. But what I see as part of this is a significant lack in leadership and governance. You know, to me, what we're looking for, leaders in the health services areas need, and the board and government need to create that culture that actually around inclusiveness and accessibility, and actually have a truly not tokenistic approach, but an approach in working with our diverse communities, including people with disability, in that human-centred design to make sure that's taken into account. So it's not about winning awards and being architecturally, architectural awards. Those awards should be granted those awards should be around recognition, around building facilities that don't aesthetically look great, but actually meeting the needs of our community and meeting the needs of the people that organisation or that building or facility serve. So I think one of the things is in leaders in organisations, it's about making sure our processes support easy access to services our people have got the necessary training and capability to work with our diverse communities, and our physical environment is welcoming and is accessible. So I think that, you know, what that story clearly demonstrates is a significant lack in that governance and leadership around supporting and supporting accessibility and inclusive environments.
Yep, I agree.
Thank you so much. Now, sorry, we don't have any time for more questions. I'm the cracker of the whip around here. So thank you again so much, Bryce. That was just, as you can see, there's plenty more questions and a lot more comments. So thank you very much.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?